The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
Ruth is a book that actually shows up in four different places in Jewish history when it comes to the canon. And we can find it after the book of Judges. We can find it after the book of Proverbs. There's only two books in the Bible that speak of the Eshet Chayil, the wife or woman of noble character, Proverbs 31 and Ruth 2. So its placement after Proverbs in some lists may be viewed as an example of Proverbs 31, woman. It's also at times buried in the sequence of five small scrolls called the Megillot, the books of Ruth, Esther, Song of Songs, Lamentations, and what am I missing? I don't think it's Ecclesiastes. Maybe it is. I don't know. But the fourth and seems to me the most authoritative, oldest list is its placement at the front of the Psalter. And it can seem kind of strange that in the days that the judges judged, Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, that it would show up, that this book would show up as a prelude to the Psalms. You'll recall that all of the books in that are in orange there, the commentary books that are offering clarification, reflection, guidance on how to read the narrative books, which frame it. All of these books are shaped in Jesus' Bible from longest book to shortest book. So Jeremiah is listed first, and it happens to be the longest. Then Ezekiel, then Isaiah, then the 12. Then we start over again, and we get Psalms, and then we get Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. And the only alteration is that Lamentations is actually a little bit longer than Song of Songs on word count. Even though Song of Songs has 8 chapters and Lamentations has 5, the Lamentations is longer, but in this unit, in this structure, all the books historically attributed to Solomon are together, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, and more importantly, Lamentations is placed at the end, allowing the whole commentary section to be framed by Jeremiah and Jeremiah. And even more importantly than that, this is what's most important, is that Lamentations, I believe, occurs right at the end of the commentary books in order to set us up for journeying back into the story. Where did the story end off in Kings? It ended off in exile in Babylon. And then Lamentations reminds us of the grief of Jerusalem's destruction, raises the question, God, I know you reign, but do you still care for us? And then we move right back into the story, picking up where it left off in Kings in the book of Daniel. Daniel's a narrative book in Jesus' Bible, and Kings ended in Babylon. Daniel picks up right away in Babylon, identifying that there's Jews in the line of David. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, all of them, Judeans in the line of David from the royal family who are still alive in Babylon. And indeed, they're going to be raised up, Daniel, to second in command of the country of the not only the country, the entire kingdom. So that's why Lamentations is at the end. But what's striking is that Ruth, then, what's that doing there? We come to Malachi, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Ruth. What's it here for? If Psalms is the biggest book, the Law of Moses, the Prophets, and the Psalms, Luke 24, 44, and the Psalms is highlighted as this elevated major book that can synthesize, this is the third division of the Old Testament. What's Ruth doing there? And because Psalms is the biggest book, I haven't put Ruth then Psalms, but rather Ruth Psalms, as if Ruth is a preface to the Psalter. That's how it seems to be set up. It's this small book thrown into the front, and then we have to say, what is this about? Well, the story in Kings ends with the Jews in exile. Malachi picks up with, oh yes, the Jews have returned to the land, but they're still in exile. They're still in slavery externally to the Persians, and they're still in slavery internally because they are not glorifying God. Their hearts are far from Him. Glory meaning honor. If you honor your father, why don't you honor me? That word honor is the exact same word translated glory elsewhere. Why aren't you glorifying me? Why aren't you honoring me? That's the question that comes in the book of Malachi. And so you've got a people who are separated from God, bound up in their sins, still in desperate need of the coming King and Savior who can free them through a great second exodus out of this bondage that at the moment is making them unreconciled with the living God. So we come to the end of Malachi, both grounded in the Law of Moses. Moses is still the king. He's still the one that they're to listen to, but anticipating a new Elijah. And I don't know what Mr. Verrett talked about 2 weeks ago, so I may repeat a few things. But when we were in 1 Kings last semester, and we came to Elijah, what we realized is that he was the only other figure beside Moses who actually got to climb Mount Sinai in the entire Old Testament. And he goes there longing to see God's glory and to hear God's voice. Why? Because he thinks he's the only prophet left. There's 7,000 more, but he thinks that he's the only one left, and he's fleeing from Jezebel, and he's saying, God, they won't listen to your word. They've given up on Moses. So give me a new word. He comes longing to hear from God as if he would be the new prophet like Moses, a new covenant mediator. But God was not in the wind. God was not in the earthquake. And then all of a sudden, what does he hear? Well, the ESV says he heard a still, small voice. I would translate it a thin silence. Nothing. He hears the crashes of the earthquake, the strong sounds of the wind, but he doesn't hear God's voice. The theophany is there, but there's no speaking. And then everything goes silent. And that's God's answer to him. You're not the new Moses. Rather, your entire life is designed to point back to him. I'm not giving you anything new. Go back and keep speaking what you're speaking. Moses is still the authority. So of all Old Testament prophets, Elijah, even though Jeremiah His words are just loaded with Moses. Isaiah is loaded with Moses. Hosea is loaded with Moses. With respect to their lives, Elijah, more than any other prophet, is elevated as the one. You arrive at him, he takes us back up to Mount Sinai, and then all of a sudden, God says, no more. Elijah, as a character, is the ultimate pointer back to Moses in the entire Old Testament. So, Deuteronomy ended here, anticipating a prophet like Moses. No prophet has arisen like Moses since he died, who did great signs and wonders and encountered God face to face. We're longing for a new prophet like Moses. But then we come to the end of the 12, and what we learn is we're also anticipating a new Elijah. And when we hear we're expecting a new Elijah, then that means he's going to be the pointer to the new Moses. That's the sense we're getting. All the Old Testament is pointing ahead to the hope beyond Moses. But you come to the end of the last of the Old Testament prophets, and he says, remember the words of my servant Moses that are written in the law. Moses is still in charge in the days of Malachi. And it's killed Israel. The law has destroyed Israel. It's put them in bondage, in slavery. In Ezekiel's vision from Ezekiel 47 or 37, they are like dry bones in a valley, as dead can be. So they need resurrection. They're in exile and need to be redeemed. That's where the story and the commentary has taken us thus far. And into that context, we read, I swapped over to Judges, back to Ruth. Sorry, I swapped over to Hebrews, back to Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. That's how Ruth begins. Judges puts all kinds of corruption into our purview. When we think about the days of the judges, we think about gross sin. Everyone doing what was right in their eyes. Why? Because there was no king in Israel. There's a famine in the land. Moses already said, famine will not happen if you obey. There's a famine in the land. Signal, curse. Ruth opens in a vision of curse and puts us in a historical provenance that is filled with brokenness, corruptness, debased actions against women, heinous crimes done by men. And it's wrong and it's cursed as God gives them over to their lustful pleasures. Sin not only being worthy of judgment, sin being the judgment itself. God gave them over. He gave them over. He gave them over. Romans 1. So it's the context we enter into Ruth, an age of chaos, an age of curse. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So, right away, this mention of Bethlehem, in verse 2, it's going to say, Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. Ephrathites. The most recent reference to the Ephrathites was in Micah 5:2. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you be small among the tribes of Judah, out of you will come for me a ruler. Remember that? Bethlehem, Ephrathah. That's Micah. Just a few chapters before this book. And Bethlehem, by its nature, is house of bread. Bethlehem. Beit lechem, house of bread. And they leave the house of bread to go to a land that is filled with people, namely the Moabites, whom God has cursed since Deuteronomy. So they have left the land of plenty, house of bread, during a famine, and gone, moved toward a sphere of curse. They're exiled away from the house of bread in a land of curse. That's where Ruth begins. And the reader is all of a sudden, I believe, supposed to be feeling, okay, what you say, why would it show up here? Why would Jews in ancient times past have even thought to put the book of Ruth before the book of Psalms as the front end to the former writings? And I think it's because they saw parallels. Between this woman, Naomi, and her deep loss, buried in exile in a land of curse, David's ancestors, who's going to be redeemed from the house of bread through a redeemer. And from her will come the preservation of the line of David. That's what happens to David's ancestors. They were in exile under curse, and God redeems them out of exile through a kinsman redeemer from Bethlehem and moves them from being empty to being filled. And as we're going to see in the book of Ruth, Ruth itself is not about Ruth. First and foremost, it's not about Ruth. It's about the hope of the Davidic kingdom. And it's about Boaz and what he provides for Ruth at a personal level is exactly what the ultimate son of David is promised to provide for all of Israel and indeed the world on a global national level. And that's why Ruth becomes a preface to the book of Psalms and invites us then to read this not as the music of David, but as the prayers of the Christ that then become the songs of the saved. That what we're going to hear in the Psalter are predictive manifestations of the tribulation and triumph of Messiah Jesus, who will do for David's descendants what Boaz did for David's ancestors. And in the process, there will even be Moabites, just as they were incorporated into the people of God in David's past. The hope is they will be, that the people of God will extend to include them in the future. That's how Ruth is going to function. So the question is, the way it was framed was, why is this book, if it's not about Ruth, why has it been co-opted for Ruth and designed to give women encouragement? And I would not say it's not designed to give women encouragement. It's just also designed to give everybody encouragement. And she is a model of a woman of faith, even a Gentile of faith. But where is she seeking? Boaz is going to say, blessed are you who has sought refuge under the wings of Yahweh. That's chapter 2, verse 12. And then in chapter 3, verse 9, she's going to say, put your own wings over me. Meaning that she recognizes God is going to be her refuge as a foreigner only via this kinsman redeemer from Bethlehem. So what I mean is even the book itself is actually deflecting focus from her onto Boaz, who is the human instrument of God's provision for his people as a whole. And always, I would say, we don't want to be what some call moralists, just looking at characters in order to find examples. Unless we can identify that's part of God's intent. And I would say that humans in the Old Testament are indeed designed to be examples for us insofar as their lives reflect the worth and value and hope of God. So God's always the main character in the story. And in this book, his provision of refuge and protection, his redeeming grace, is going to come through one man, and Ruth is going to identify that when she says, "Put me under your wings." And when a chapter before, Boaz himself said, "You have come to find refuge under the wings of the Lord." So it would be similar to this in response to your question. Those that preach leadership out of Nehemiah and act as though that's what the book is about, I think miss the core essence of the book. But it doesn't mean you can't learn about leadership from Nehemiah. That's also part of the message, but it's subordinate to what it's ultimately pointing to. God's return of his people to the land in order to remind us of their desperate need for the Messiah and his provision that he will raise him up from the land. That's the focus, needs to be the focus of our preaching, not our people need to obey their leaders, so we better pull out Nehemiah and let them hear it from the Lord. Our first response in Old Testament narrative should be, who or what is God doing? And how do I relate to who or what he is doing? And probably the main point is going to be found there, rather than, this is first and foremost an example for me to follow. These books are about God and his purpose, his kingdom purposes through his Messiah, and only secondarily about us and how we engage that Messiah and hope in this God. But we learn proper perspective on faith and hope and love as we work through these books. But we do so only in a framework that we're properly understanding who God is and what his purposes are. So, basic structure of this book. We've got an introduction where the crisis is established. Naomi is empty, and she's a picture of Israel who is empty in the midst of exile. The main part of the book, hope and challenge. The rise of a redeemer from Bethlehem. And it seems as though this book is structured and its placement identifies that. So we know the book was written after David has come, because the last word of the book is David. David is already on the throne. They know that he has been exalted over all. Whenever this book was written, it was written after David has become who he is on his throne, which further implies after God has given David all the kingdoms of the earth and made these global promises about an eternal kingdom. Ruth is written in light of those promises from 2 Samuel 7. So we read about this redeemer from Bethlehem, and all of a sudden, in light of its placement within the canonical context, Micah 5:2 is by, without question, rising in our minds. This shepherd king who would rise from Bethlehem, Ephrathah, in order to overcome darkness and fix the sin problem. All this is part of Micah. Defeat his enemies and establish global peace. All of that is on our minds, I think, as we're coming into this book, because we're reading through Jesus' Bible, and this is where we are in the discussion. So it's setting us up to, we already, before we ever read a phrase in the book of Ruth, we already have the messianic hope and the kingdom promises on our mind, and they're centralized on David, who will rise from Bethlehem. And his son will come, his future son will have an eternal kingdom. And he's the one who will defeat the serpent and overcome evil and inaugurate the new creation. The conclusion, rescue, and epilogue, Naomi is filled because Boaz marries Ruth and they have Obed, who gives rise to Jesse, and Jesse's the father of David. And David is the father of the coming Messiah. Naomi is filled, and then all of a sudden at the end of the book, we're going to see a whole bunch of recollections back to the book of Genesis, both through the 10-member linear genealogy that ends the book. That shoots us all the way back to Genesis chapter 5, Genesis chapter 11, both of which were the two linear genealogies. A gave birth to B and other kids. B gave birth to C and other kids. C gave birth to D and other kids. This straight line from Adam to Noah, who had Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and from Shem all the way to Terah, who had Abraham, Nahor, and one other brother, whatever his name was. So it takes us back there. It takes us all the way back to Judah and the other major levirate marriage. Levir in Latin is brother-in-law. And that's how in Deuteronomy 25, we're going to see this whole idea of your husband dies and it's his brother's, the sense I get, single brother's responsibility to step up and then marry this bride and have offspring. And if there's no brother-in-law, Ruth tells us it can extend to further relatives. That's what the Redeemer is, in order to preserve the line of the original brother or original relative. And you'll remember, I'm just jumping all the way through this book and I haven't even read it yet. At the end of the book, it's going to go to Judah and Tamar. And Tamar was Judah's daughter-in-law. You remember that story? And Judah's oldest son dies because of his sin. His second oldest son dies because of his sin. He's got a third son, but he won't give that third son to his first son's wife, Tamar. So Tamar dresses up as a prostitute, and she, in the process, steals Judah's driver's license. And she gets pregnant, and 4.5 months later, when it's clear she's pregnant, Judah says, kill her. She says, here's the driver's license of the man that impregnated me. And Judah says, you're more righteous than me. You remember that story? Driver's license was really a donkey cart ownership thing. He had a staff, and it proved, though, that it was him. So that's the only other major levirate marriage story in the Old Testament. And it specifically relates to the rise of Perez, who's their offspring, who then is, he's the one who then carries on the line that brings us to David. And all of those promises given to Abraham, which build off of Genesis 3:15, the offspring of the woman crushing the head of the serpent, who's then going to be the offspring of Abraham, who will possess enemy gates and through whom the nations will be blessed. And in his days, the land of Canaan will expand to lands covering the globe. And he will be in the line of Judah, Genesis 49, and crush Moab's head and raise the scepter All of those promises from Genesis are instilled into the very end of Ruth when it recalls key moments and key players in that book. And then it brings us to David. And it's placed within the canon after the story's already told us the whole kingdom of David has passed away. The monarchy is destroyed. Oh yes, Israel's back in the land, but there's still slaves. There's no king. And this book comes in and says there's hope for the descendants of David. Don't forget how God delivered his ancestors. And it sets us up then for reading the story in the book of Psalms for how he'll deliver David's descendants through a new redeemer from Bethlehem. That's how I understand the book of Ruth and why it's where it's at. So let's walk through it. Already noted how the mention of the judges and the famine in the land recalls an age of curse and depravity, of brokenness and decay. They leave the house of bread, Bethlehem, of Judah, and they go to the country of Moab, and they remained there. But then Elimelech dies, and her sons take two Moabite wives, and then the boys die. And there's a crisis. And that's where we're at. A crisis that, yes, it's a crisis on a family scale, but if God had ordained that it was going to be through this line in Judah, coming from Judah, this line in Judah, this line from Bethlehem, that God would preserve the seed through whom all the world would be blessed, then the crisis in Ruth is not simply one family, it's a global crisis, according to God's providence. It's similar to the barrenness of Sarah. God had ordained that Abraham was the man, but his wife was barren. So it would take a miracle for he to be the agent through whom the world would be blessed. But he believed God, trusting God to do for him what he could not do on his own. That's the nature of saving, justifying faith. Trusting God to do for him what he could not do on his own, ultimately through the offspring promise. And it's very comparable to what we're seeing here. It will take a miracle because they can't perform levirate marriage. At least it appears so. Both brothers are dead. Both Moabite women have lost their husbands, and they haven't told us anymore in the family, except they left Bethlehem. But they're not there anymore. They're in exile, separated. Is there still hope for this family of David? I mean, family, they're not of David yet, family of Abraham in the line of Judah. Is there still hope? So we come to 1:5. Mahlon and Chilion died so that the women were left without their sons, so that the women were left without their husbands, rather, and Naomi is without her sons. Naomi says to her girls, "Turn back, my daughters," verse 11. "Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands?" It sounds weird to us, but it's all about the preservation of property and the preservation of a people in hope of the Messiah. Now that Jesus has come, levirate marriage doesn't continue. Paul makes that clear at the end of 1 Corinthians 7, when he says, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, period. Only in the Lord. So in Christ, something happens wherein the need to preserve the land, not lands, the land of Canaan, and the need to preserve the people who would fill that land and from whom the Messiah would come, that's what levirate marriage was for. And it's not needed today because the Messiah has come. Something's changed. But in this day, it was needed. And she says, I can't raise up more boys. I'm too old. Do you think I'm going to get married? Anybody's going to want me? Or even that my womb could be opened up at this age? It's just not going to happen. Happened to Sarah, but she didn't think it could happen to her. So, verse 13. Verse 12, if I should say I have hope, even I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait until I was grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it's exceedingly bitter, Mara, for me, for your sake, that the hand of Yahweh has gone out against me. Now, it's clear she has a big view of God's sovereignty. And we may raise the question, is she right? Did God cause such bitterness to her? She believes he did. That question will be answered more clearly by when we get to the book of Job. But she tells these girls, leave, but verse 15, see, your sister-in-law has gone back. You go too, Ruth. Return like your sister-in-law. But Ruth says, do not urge me to leave you, to return from following you. Where you go, I'll go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God, my God. That's not a passing comment. That's the covenant formula. She's binding herself, even as a Moabite, to Israel and to Israel's God. That's just amazing. She has just forsaken, just like Abraham appears to have done when he was in Haran and his family were moon worshipers, says Joshua chapter 24. He said no to that life and yes to following the promises of God. Now we've got a Moabitess who's living like Abraham, forsaking all and identifying herself wholly, even though everything on the surface appears that it's going to mean nothing for her future, at least immediately. Eternally, yes. So, Naomi says this in verse 20, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. That's bitter from the previous verses. For the Almighty has dealt with me bitterly. I went away full, husband, two sons, gained two daughters. The Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when Yahweh has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, where? To Bethlehem. Ruth the Moabite, her daughter, went with her. And they returned from Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The barley harvest transitions us to the new scene because there's people out harvesting. There's fields and young men and masters. And what's amazing is that the portrait now of this man, Boaz, is going to be completely different than the portrait of the men in the book of Judges. In the days that the judges judged, the men in the book of Judges are thoroughly corrupt, but there is one man in Bethlehem. We only know of one, but there is one in Bethlehem who is what is called here a worthy man, chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 4, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. He said to his reapers, Yahweh be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. This is a man who blesses rather than abuses. That's a different kind of master than we read about in the book of Judges. Verses 8 and 9, Boaz said to Ruth, listen, my daughter, don't go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Notice he's not only providing for her, he is protecting her. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink with the young men what the young men have drawn. Remember the story when Jacob's servant goes northward to Haran to find a wife for Isaac. And the servant arrives and the women are out at the well getting the water. Here the men have gathered the water already for the women. And the master is watching them, guiding them, do not touch these maidens. That is, go back and read the book of Judges. It is completely contrary to what we read there. Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes because there was no king in Israel. But somehow, this man is different. And according to the book of Judges, it must have something to do with, if there's no king, it's the hoped for king. But the age is the same. There was no king in the age of human king in the days of the judges. There's no king in the days of the exile for Israel. But he's different. As if hoping for the king is enough to make you a different kind of a man when it comes to how you engage women. But this is the context in which redemption happens, the context in which God's image is displayed, the context in which hope is realized. So we come to verse 12. The Lord repay you for what you've done. A full reward be given to you, says Boaz to Ruth. A full reward from whom? By the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. There it is. All this movement out of exile, back toward the house of bread, a foreigner aligning herself with Yahweh. Why? To find refuge from all the chaos, all the brokenness, all the darkness, all the hurt. Yahweh is my answer. I won't flee from him in the midst of pain. I'm going to run toward him. And Boaz recognizes that's exactly what Ruth has done. And he describes it as if God is this mother bird that is protecting. So Ruth goes back to her mom, mother-in-law. Verse 19, where'd you glean today and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I worked is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by Yahweh, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. So though she feels empty and bitter, something clicks. The whole context of a redeemer and how even though her husband and sons are dead, there could still be some hope. That the name of Elimelech could be elevated once again. But it's at cost. It will come at a cost, as we're going to see. So here's the challenge. Naomi says, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? He's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. I want you to go meet him. Clean your body. Look beautiful. And go and make a proposal. Now, we have to raise the question, why is he not married? And he's a man of means. He has many servants and much turf. So even though the story doesn't tell us, it's most likely that he is a widower. And there's nothing in the story to suggest that he's expecting any other bride to come from him. But he's a man of means. He has many under his care. And she comes as this young woman to the relative of her father-in-law. We read these words, verse 9. "Who are you?" She answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." He understands immediately what she is asking. She's not, it doesn't appear, under his blanket with him. She is requesting that he be willing to let her come underneath. And he says, "I am willing, but there's a catch. There's another man who's closer than I am." But it's in this context that I don't think there's anything weird going on here. She uncovers his ankles, potentially, disclosing his sandals, which are going to play a big part at the end of the story. It's at least in the region where the sandals are. And the sandal is going to be part of the ceremony wherein he becomes the redeemer. And she's asking him, "Will you become a redeemer for me?" He says to her, "It's true that I am a redeemer," verse 12 of chapter 3, "yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, then good. Let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as Yahweh lives, before the living God, I tell you that I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." And she lay at his feet, but arose before one could recognize another, and went back. So there's the challenge. Nobleman, one of the few in the Judges period, redeemer. And yet he's not the nearest kinsman, and therefore it's not potential for him immediately. There needs to be a discussion. So where do they go? They go to where everything happens in the Old Testament, at the city gate. The city gate was built into the walls. It could be 15 to 25 feet wide, and it has big corridors cut out, and the elders of the city would sit inside the city gate where they would do all of their politics and all of their querying and questioning and judging. So this is city center, as it were, where all the administration is taking place. And so he goes and hangs out there the next day. Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city, verse 2 of chapter 4, "Sit down here." So they sat. He said to the redeemer who was there, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, but in the presence of those sitting here and the presence of the elders of my people, if you'll redeem it, then do so. But if not, tell me so that I can redeem it." And he said, "Oh, I'll take more property. I like that. I'll claim whatever I can." But then Boaz raises the issue. He says, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi," verse 5, "you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Now, this seems so foreign to us, but And it's not all super clear because we only have two major texts that address this issue, Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10, and here. But the sense we get is that the very first child So this man, we don't have any evidence anywhere, either way, but we don't have any evidence that this man was married yet. Meaning, there's no examples of levirate marriage requiring you to take on a second wife. Everyone who engages in levirate marriage in the Old Testament is always single. And the discussions of what marriage is in the Old Testament suggest to me that there's an understood implication, I might be wrong, but that you only can engage in this idea of a redeemer if you're a single man. But what's at stake? You have to be single, and then you have to recognize that your first son, through this relationship, is going to receive rights to this land. It's not your rights, it's the rights of the dead relative. So you're entering in, you're gaining a wife, but you're also recognizing that the property that will be bestowed to your firstborn son will not be counted as yours, and what is gained from it will not be yours. It will be to the relative of the dead, the spouse of the dead relative. And therefore, if you have no more sons, your own name and your own estate is in jeopardy. Because the firstborn son is all of a sudden connected with this other family. That's how I understand the challenge and why it is that the first man says, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. And yet Boaz is willing to do just that for the sake of preserving the line of his family member and out of love and respect for both Naomi and Ruth. So Boaz is willing to do it, and through him the Messiah is going to come. They have the entire sandal swapping ceremony. It sounds really funny to us. But I remember when, in the early 1990s, some of you were alive then, and Saddam Hussein was overcome in Iraq. And I remember pictures of the Iraqis in the Battle for Iraqi Freedom when they pulled down this giant 15-foot tall statue of Saddam Hussein, and it came over and they took their sandals off and kept touching his head, not smacking it, just touching it, identifying that he was under their feet. And what's being identified here, it appears to me, is there is an act of shame that's being declared over this man who is unwilling to carry on the name of his family member. She uncovered Boaz's feet, identifying, I want you to put your wings over me. He takes off his sandal and in doing so, raises it up and identifies the shamefulness of this other man unwilling to trust in God for his future inheritance. And Ruth becomes Boaz's. Verse 11, all the people were at the gate. All the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May Yahweh, listen, make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. Who were they? They were the wives of Jacob, who give rise to the tribes of Israel. So if this new child is going to be like them, I mean, if Ruth is going to be like them, what does it imply? That from her would come a new Israel. And that's exactly what the prophets hope in. But not only a new Israel, these who built up together the house of Israel, may you act worthily in Ephrathah and renown in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that Yahweh will give you by this young woman. From Perez comes an entire people group. So Rachel and Leah give rise to the tribes of Israel. And then among those tribes is Judah. And from Perez comes the entire house of Judah, out of whom will rise the Messiah. Genesis 49 already gets us to that point. And so in recalling Perez, it's recalling those messianic promises. A new Israel and a flourishing coming king. Verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife and he went into her and Yahweh, by his grace, gave her conception and she bore a son. And what did the women say? Blessed be Yahweh who has not left you this day without a redeemer. May his name be renowned in Israel. Verse 17, and the women of the neighborhood gave the son a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So, this book is loaded with hope. It's loaded with a light of blessing in a context of desperate curse, of a movement out of exile and emptiness into flourishing. And it all hinges on an individual kinsman redeemer from Bethlehem whose very life under your wings displays the providing, protecting, redeeming, rescuing hand of God. He is the ultimate imager of God in this story. As Ruth finds refuge under his wings, she is doing nothing less than finding refuge under the wings of God. And so, what does this message have to do with those living in exile in desperate need of kingdom hope? Everything. So God promised to do through David's future son on a national level what Boaz supplied on a personal level. Just as the Lord delivered David's ancestors from exile through a kinsman redeemer from Bethlehem, he would do the same for David's descendants. So I summarize the book this way. Just as the Lord redeemed David's ancestors and preserved the messianic line by filling Naomi's emptiness through the Bethlehemite redeemer Boaz's marrying of Ruth, so God will redeem David's descendants by filling their emptiness and expanding them to include the nations through a new redeemer from Bethlehem, David's greater son. That's my take on the book of Ruth. Questions? Right. Good question. And here's honestly where it gets more fuzzy. Because the way the genealogy is set up, it's clear that it's still Boaz's son. And so the question is, if he's Mahlon's son, that is Mahlon's heir, it's still obvious that in the genealogy, he's not treated that way. This is now in the line of Boaz, that it's from Boaz and Ruth comes Obed to Jesse to David, rather than from Ruth and Mahlon comes Obed. So biologically, the seed doesn't come through Naomi. It comes through Ruth and Boaz. But the inheritance rights that govern the story are still in some way related to Mahlon. And I think the point there is to identify that love and trust outweighed fear in Boaz's personal life. He was a man of faith. And so the whole issue of the inheritance rights is to highlight him as a man of faith, whereas the genealogical focus of the book in reminding us of the hope of the coming kingdom of David is all intended to highlight less his faith and more his agency of the Messiah. But we have to somehow figure out how verse 5 of chapter 4, I'm going to perpetuate the name of the dead in the inheritance, is to compare with, which is exactly then what Boaz does. He perpetuates Elimelech's family name through the birth of Obed. But still, Obed is counted genealogically as his own. And when we render the genealogy of Christ, Boaz is there as the agent with Ruth through whom the Messiah comes. So all I'm saying is it's tricky, and I don't have all the answers, but you're recognizing a tension. But I think it's relieved if we just recognize one is focused on genealogy, one is focused on faith, and the two different sides are both true. Just to note something, you can track linear genealogies from this point in Genesis 5, Genesis 11, and Ruth 4. Those linear genealogies move you from Adam to Noah, from Shem to Abraham, and then you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah within the context of the book of Genesis, and then this genealogy takes us all the way to David. It's like they want us to be able to recognize that from Eve and the promise in Genesis 3:15, God is preserving generation after generation after generation to get us to Messiah Christ. That's exactly what it's doing. And Matthew is going to open up again with a recollection 10 times in Genesis. This is these are the generations of Genesis 5:1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. And Matthew is going to open up, this is the book of the generations of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then it's going to be 14 generations from Adam to David, and 14 generations from David to the exile, and 14 generations from the exile to Jesus in Matthew chapter 1. And those 14 generations are actually telescoped. We know there were other people in there, whereas back in Genesis, there doesn't appear to be other people at all because dates are listed, how old they were when they had the child and when they died. Those are unique genealogies that I don't think can alter the time frame of what's being set out there. But some genealogies can be, telescope the word? Microscope? I don't know. Like Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. You know, there's lots of generations between each one of those, that mini genealogy. And Matthew uses ellipsis in order to highlight structure by numbers and the purpose of God in bringing us to the Christ. There is another question after Michaela. Let me just go back to Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. Good observation. So if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife. Notice that the brothers are dwelling together. And perform the duty of the husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate the brother's name in Israel. He'll not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. That language suggests to me it's not sinful to say no, it's just improper. Failing to step up and do your duty is the language of the text. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, it sounds like, and says, I do not wish to take her. So they're trying to say, do your duty, do your duty. It's not a sin for him to say no. He can't be punished in court for it, but it's still wrong. And then it says, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. So it's that context of shame that I'm reading into Ruth. But the more immediate verse that you draw attention to, and it would be the only place that we would see the sandal mentioned. They assume the reader needs to learn more. This was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. Notice there, it's not just about when you want to buy property or purchase a pot. It's specifically set up in the context of redeeming and exchanging. And so it, to confirm the transaction, the spitting in the face is what suggests to me this is, maybe I said it's not shameful. Maybe it is shameful, but it's not sinful. If we can, there's something, you're not performing your duty for me. I loved your brother and you're not willing to perpetuate his name. And this will bring an end to me. And you're not willing to love within the family in that way. So that, it's that context that makes me think that the, even though it doesn't mention it explicitly in verse 7, it just says this is the way that they did things back then. The fact that it puts it in the context of redemption and exchange does take us back to Deuteronomy 25, and it's Deuteronomy 25 that seems to portray this as a wrong kind of act. That's why I said what I did. Yes, Ben. Psalm 60, verse 8. Well, I hadn't noticed that, but let me do a little biblical theology. We've just gone through Obadiah. Obadiah is judged because of their failure to provide and protect Judah. Instead, they participate in their loss and capture the Judeans as they run away, and they plunder Jerusalem. So those who should have been providing and protecting don't. And in such a context, it's Isaiah 54, right after Isaiah 53, that God portrays himself as a redeemer Israel has been sold into slavery through their idolatry. In the language of Hosea chapter 2, they've been given over to other lovers. Hosea chapter 3, they're actually held as slaves and need to be purchased. But God says in Isaiah 52, he will enter in and purchase Jerusalem back, and he will be their redeemer. And the very means by which he will do that is through the death and resurrection of his servant king. So all of that, it puts it into a context. It tells me that Edom in particular might have the sandal issue because it may be in the context of this redemption where they as sibling, Esau versus Jacob, they as sibling should have played a role of protection and provision and didn't. And God will redeem. I don't know. It's very thoughtful. I'd never seen that passage, and I want to make a note of it. First Moses and then Brad. Well, the first text, Amos 2:6, I've only read that as, I haven't read it in relation to the tradition that we're talking about in levirate marriage. I've only read it in the sense of you're treating someone's shoes as more valuable than they are as a person. And so, and it's just wrong. What was the, after chapter 2, what was the other passage? Amos what? 8:6. Yeah, same exact context. You're selling the needy for a pair of sandals. My initial response is that it doesn't have anything to do with our tradition, with the tradition that we're talking about, but instead has to do with the lack of valuing a human, so that you're taking their sandal. But maybe there's more to it. It could be. I would just have to think more about it. Great question. Brad? The question is, how much would Boaz have actually understood regarding messianic hope and the fact that he was living in Bethlehem and in the line of Judah? And, I mean, was he raised as a child to think maybe God will raise the Messiah through you? And did he have a sense, like you said, Matthew 16:25? If you'll lose your life for my sake, you'll gain it. How much was he driven by such hope and such truth? And I think Moses was available to him, and he, like the other prophets, is living like one who has such hope. He is countercultural. Reading Ruth in light of the book of Judges, as it calls us to in Ruth 1:1, he is living, not doing what is right in his own eyes, but meaning apart from God, but is rather living with such a high ethic, as if he's one who's hoping in such things. But all we've got is this book. So it's hard. So I think it's very possible that he is being driven. I mean, his first words to Ruth are, or right up there in his first words, first day, he meets this girl and he says, "Blessed are you who has come to find refuge under the wings of Yahweh." He's not putting himself up above Yahweh. He recognizes God's at the top. He's my God, and you have come even to this field today in order to find refuge under him. And that's how he's living, as a man under authority, imaging the steadfast love of God and the mercy of God to others. So the book, it seems to me, is calling us to see him in this unique sphere of truly loving and living for Yahweh, even in light of messianic hope. And the words of the women or of the community at the end of the book, linking back to Leah and Rachel and linking back to Judah and Tamar with Perez. I mean, we don't know how much they were thinking, but within the flow of the book and its placement in the canon, we're supposed to be thinking messianic hope. It's calling us to think about the promises given to Abraham. And it raises the likelihood that indeed Boaz himself, this is how he's living. This is how he's thinking about his life and practice. Yeah, whether he is taking that step, it would be hard for me to prove that he truly believes this is the moment of redemptive history. Either it's you or it's me who's going to be the agent of the Messiah. I don't know how I could prove that. That seems like it'd be too much to state. But it does seem to me clear that he is living in the light of such messianic hope. He's acting in accordance with God as his king and in alignment with the promises given to Abraham and Judah. Well, if you look at verse 6 of chapter 1, it says that Naomi only arose with her daughter-in-laws to return from Moab to Bethlehem when she had heard while in the fields of Moab that Yahweh had visited his people and given them bread. So it says food in my ESV, but it's lechem. He gave, so in the house of bread, bread has come. And specifically, it's barley. And it's the barley harvest. And God has allowed the harvest to grow. So yeah, the signal is they recognize while they're in exile that God is doing a work in the land. And in that sense, it invites us to compare we're not there yet. By the time we get to Ezra and Nehemiah, and we see that people like Ezra and Nehemiah here, while they're up in Persia, about what's happening in Jerusalem and that God is rebuilding things and yet that there's chaos, it may move us to even recall the story of Ruth. That while in exile, they hear that God is doing a work and it moves them out of exile back to the land. Certainly, we could say they were motivated by the promises given to Jeremiah and to Isaiah that the exile would be 70 years long and that one named Cyrus would be the one to return them to the land. So Daniel comes, next book, or coming up, first narrative book that follows, and he's going to be hoping in Daniel chapter 9, hoping he's been counting and the 70 years is coming to an end, and then he goes and he prays to God. It seems as though it's time to return. So in that sense, okay, God, you've already said you're going to do a work back in the land, and we want to be a part of it. That's the movement that's happening. I think it supports a historical, grammatical, theological reading of the Psalms. I'm not going to separate the two. You're going to see me argue for what you're calling a theological reading of the Psalms from the Psalms itself. And that David intended that from the beginning. That's what I'm going to argue.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.